The seventh illusion, the illusion of condemnation, may be used to experience the fact that you are deserving of nothing but praise. This is something that you cannot fathom, for you live so deeply with your illusion of condemnation. If, however, you lived within the heart of praise every moment, you could not experience it. Praise would mean nothing to you. You would not know what it was. The glory of praise is lost when praise is all there is. Yet you have taken this awareness to an extreme, taking the illusion of imperfection and condemnation to new levels, where you now actually believe praise to be wrong, especially self-praise. You are not to praise yourself or to notice, much less announce, the glory of who you are. And you must be sparing in your praise of others. Praise, you have concluded, is not good. The illusion of condemnation is also your announcement that you, and God, can be damaged. Exactly the opposite is true, of course, but you cannot know this truth nor experience it in the absence of any other reality. And so you have created an alternate reality in which damage is possible, and condemnation is proof of it. To repeat, the idea that you, or God, can be damaged is an illusion. If God is the all in all, and I am, and if God is the most powerful, and I am, and if God is the supreme being, it is true, then God is incapable of being hurt or damaged. And if you are made in the image and likeness of God, and you are, then you cannot be hurt or damaged either. Condemnation is a device you have created to help you experience the wonder of this by producing a context within which this truth can have meaning. It is one of the many lesser illusions that evolve every day from the 10 illusions. The first illusion, that God and you need something, is what creates the illusion that if you don't get what you need, God in you will be injured, hurt, or damaged. This sets up the perfect case for retribution. And this is not a small, but a very big illusion. Nothing has captured the imagination of humans more completely than the idea that hell exists, that there is a place in the universe to which God condemns those who have not obeyed his law. Frightening, gruesome pictures of this horrific place appear in frescoes on the ceilings and walls of churches all over the world. Equally upsetting images adorn the pages of catechism texts and Sunday school booklets given to little children, the better to scare them with. And while good, church-going people have for centuries believed the messages that these images send, it happens that the message is false. That is why I inspired Pope John Paul II to indicate to a papal audience at the Vatican, July 28, 1999, that improper use of biblical pictures must not create psychosis or anxiety. The biblical descriptions of hell are symbolic and metaphorical. I inspired the Pope to say that the inextinguishable fire and the burning oven the Bible speaks of indicate the complete frustration and vacuity of a life without God. Hell is a state of separation from God, he explained, a state caused not by a punishing God, but rather self-induced. It is not God's function to administer retribution or to punish anyone, and the Pope made that clear in his audience. Still, the idea of a condemning God has been a useful illusion. It has created a context within which you could experience all manner of things, many aspects of being. Fear, for instance, or forgiveness, compassion, and mercy, too. A condemned man understands at the deepest level the expression of mercy. So does the person doing the condemning or the granting of pardon. Forgiveness is another nuance of the expression of love that it has served your species to experience. Forgiveness is experienced only in young, primitive cultures. Advanced cultures have no need for it, understanding that since there can be no damage, no forgiveness is necessary. But it has enormous value within the context of evolution, the process by which cultures mature and grow. Forgiveness allows you to heal virtually any psychological, emotional, spiritual, and sometimes even physical wound that you imagine has been inflicted upon you. Forgiveness is a great healer. You can literally forgive your way to health. You can forgive your way to happiness. Your use of the illusion of condemnation has been very creative in this regard, creating many moments in your life and in human history in which forgiveness could be expressed. You have experienced this as an aspect of divine love, moving you closer and closer to the truth of both love and divinity itself. One of the most famous stories of forgiveness that has done this is the account of Jesus forgiving the man on the cross beside him, revealing the eternal truth that no one is condemned who seeks God. This means that no one is ever condemned because everyone ultimately seeks God, whether they call it that or not. Hell is the experience of separation from God, yet anyone who does not wish to experience eternal separation does not have to. The mere desire for reunion with God produces it. That is an extraordinary statement, and I'm going to repeat it. The mere desire for reunion with God produces it. Forgiveness is never necessary, since no true offense can ever be committed by or against divinity itself, given that divinity itself is all that is. This is something that advanced cultures understand. Who would forgive whom, and for what? Does the hand forgive the toe for stubbing itself? Does the eye forgive the ear? The hand may comfort the toe, true enough. It may rub it and heal it and make it better. But does it need to forgive the toe? Or could it be that forgiving is just another word for comforting in the language of the soul? I have inspired it to be written, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." When your culture, too, understands this, you will never again condemn yourself or another for those times when the soul is stubbing a toe. You will never again embrace a vengeful, angry, damning God who would condemn you to everlasting torture for what would, to God, surely be less than the stubbing of a toe. In that moment, you will relinquish forever your idea of a condemning God, for you will know that love could never condemn. Then you will condemn no one, and nothing either, according to my injunction, judge not and neither condemn. Always remember that. Judge not and neither condemn.
The Eighth Illusion. The illusion of conditionality may be used to experience that aspect of yourself which exists without condition, and which can love without condition for that very reason. You are an unconditional being, yet you cannot know that you are an unconditional being because there is no condition in which you are not unconditional. You are therefore in no condition. This is true, literally. You are in no condition to do anything. You can only be. Yet pure beingness does not satisfy you. For this reason, you have created the illusion of conditionality. This is the idea that one part of you, one part of life, one part of God, depends on another in order to be. This is an outgrowth or an enlargement of your illusion of disunity, which in turn springs from your illusion of need, which is the first illusion. There is really only one illusion, and everything else is as an enlargement of that, like a balloon blowing up. It is from the illusion of conditionality that what you call relativity was created. Hot and cold, for instance, are really not opposites, but the very same thing in a different condition. Everything is the same thing. There's only one energy, and that is the energy you call life. The word God may be used interchangeably here. It is the individual and specific vibration of this energy that you refer to as its condition. Under certain conditions, certain things occur and appear to be what you would call true. For instance, up is up and down is down, under certain conditions. Your astronauts learned that in outer space, definitions of up and down disappeared. Truth changed because conditions changed. Changing conditions create changing truth. Truth is nothing more than a word meaning what is so right now. Yet what is so is always changing. Therefore, truth is always changing. Your world has shown you this. Your life has demonstrated this to you. The process of life is, in fact, change. Reduced to one word, life is change. God is life. Therefore, God is change. In one word, God is change. God is a process. Not a being, but a process. And that process is called change. Some of you might prefer the word evolution. God is the energy that evolves, or that which becomes. That which becomes needs no special condition in order to become. Life simply becomes what it becomes, and in order for you to define it, describe it, quantify it, measure it, and try to control it, you ascribe certain conditions to it. Yet life has no conditions. It simply is. Life is what it is. I am that I am. You may now fully understand this ancient enigmatic statement for the first time. When you know that conditions must appear to exist in order for you to experience non-conditionality, that is, in order for you to know God, you will bless the conditions of your life and every condition that you have ever experienced. These conditions have allowed you to experience that you are larger than any of them, larger than all of them combined. Your life has shown you this. Think of this for a moment, and you will see that this is true. Imagine a condition in which you have found yourself, in which you have imagined yourself to be. Have you ever risen above that condition to discover that you have overcome it? In truth, you did not overcome it at all. You never were it. You simply threw off your idea that this condition in which you found yourself was you. You saw yourself as bigger than that, other than that. I am not my condition, you may have said. I am not my handicap. I am not my job. I am not my wealth or lack of it. I am not this. This is not who I am. People have made such declarations have produced extraordinary experiences in their lives, extraordinary outcomes. They have thus used the illusion of conditionality to recreate themselves anew, in the next grandest version of the greatest vision they ever held about who they are. Because of this, there are those who have blessed the very conditions of life that others have condemned. For they have embraced these conditions as a great gift, allowing them to see and declare the truth of their being. When you bless the conditions of your life, you change them. For you are calling them something other than what they appear to be, even as you are calling yourself something other than what you appear to be. It is at this point that you begin to consciously create, and not merely notice, the conditions and circumstances of your life. For you will know that you have always been and always will be the perceiver and the definer of every condition. What one person perceives as poverty, you may perceive as abundance. What one person defines as defeat, you may define as victory, as you will when you decide that every failure is a success. Thus you will experience yourself as the creator of every condition, its imaginer, if you will, but only if it is your will, since true conditionality does not exist. In that moment, you will cease blaming any other person, place, or thing in your life for the life of your experience. And the whole of your experience, past, present, and future, will change. You will know that you have never truly been victimized, and what you know, you will grow. Ultimately, you will realize that there are no victims. Always remember that. There are no victims.